such urgency as to force an old man like Lord Dunsany outside on a day like this, let alone over the rutted road to Ellesmere. Some word had come from Ellesmere, and it could only concern the Lady Geneva or her child. Hearing through the servants' gossip that Lady Geneva was due to be delivered in January, he had counted quickly backward, cursed Geneva Dunsany once more, and then said a hasty prayer for her safe delivery. Since then, he had done his best not to think about it. He had been with her only 3 days before her wedding. He couldn't be sure. A week before, Lady Dunsany had gone to Ellesmere to be with her daughter. Since then, she had sent daily messengers home to fetch the dozen things she had forgotten to take and must have at once, and each of them, upon arrival at Hellwater, had reported, "No news yet." Now there was news, and it was plainly bad. Passing back toward the front of the coach, after the latest battle with the mud, he saw the Lady Isabel's face peering out from beneath the isinglass sheet that covered the window. "Oh, Mackenzie," she said, her face contorted in fear and distress. "Please, is it much further?" He leaned close to shout in her ear over the gurgle and rush of the gullies running down both sides of the road.
"Geoffrey says it's 4 mile yet, my lady. 2 hours, maybe."
If the damned and hell-bent coach didn't tip itself and its hapless passengers off the Ashness Bridge into Wattendlath Tarn, he added silently to himself. Isabel nodded her thanks and lowered the window, but not before he had seen that the wetness upon her cheeks was due as much to tears as to the rain. The snake of anxiety wrapped round his heart slithered lower to twist in his guts. It was closer to 3 hours by the time the coach rolled at last into the courtyard at Ellesmere. Without hesitation, Lord Dunsany leapt down and, scarcely pausing to give his younger daughter an arm, hurried into the house. It took nearly another hour to unharness the team, rub down the horses, wash the caked-on mud from the coach's wheels, and put everything away in Ellesmere's stable. Numb with cold, fatigue and hunger, he and Jeffreys sought refuge and sustenance in Ellesmere's kitchens.
"Poor fellows, you've gone right blue with a cold," the cook observed. "Sit you down here and I'll soon have your hot bite."
A sharp-faced, spare-framed woman, her figure belied her skill, for within minutes a huge savoury omelette was laid before them, garnished with liberal amounts of bread and butter and a small pot of jam.
"Fair, quite fair," Jeffreys pronounced,
casting an appreciative eye on the spread. He winked at the cook.
"Not as it wouldn't go down easier wi' a drop or something to pave the way. You look the sort would have mercy on a pair of poor half-frozen chaps, wouldn't you, darling?"
Whether it was this piece of Irish persuasion or the sight of their dripping, steaming clothes, the argument had its effect, and a bottle of cooking brandy made its appearance next to the peppermill. Jeffreys poured a large tot and drank it off without hesitation, smacking his lips.
"Ah, that's more like. Here, boyo."
He passed the bottle to Jamie, then settled himself comfortably to a hot meal and gossip with the female servants.
"Well, then, what's to do here? Is the babe born yet?"
"Oh, yes, last night," the kitchen maid said eagerly. "We were up all night with the doctor coming and fresh sheets and towels called for and the household topsail turvy. But the babe's the least of it."
"Now then," the cook broke in, frowning censoriously, "there's too much work to be standing about gossiping. Get your on, Marianne, up to the study, and see if his lordship be wanting anything else served now."
Jamie, wiping his plate with a slice of bread, observed that the maid, far from being abashed at this rebuke, departed with alacrity, causing him to deduce that something of considerable interest was likely transpiring in the study. The undivided attention of her audience thus obtained, the cook allowed herself to be persuaded into imparting the gossip with no more than a token demur.
"Well, it started some months ago, when the Lady Geneva started to show, poor thing.
"'His lordship's been nicer than pie to her ever since they was married. "'Couldn't do enough for her. "'Anything she wanted ordered from London, "'always asking was she warm enough, "'had what she wanted to eat. "'Fair doting his lordship was. "'But then, when he found she was with child—'
"'The cook paused to screw up her face portentously. "'Jamie wanted desperately to know about the child.' What was it, and how did it fare? There seemed no way to hurry the woman, though, so he composed his face to look as interested as possible, leaning forward encouragingly.
"'Why, the shouting and the carryings on!'
the cook said, throwing up her hands in dismayed illustration.
"'Him shouting, her crying, and the both of them stamping up and down and slamming doors, and him calling her names as isn't fit to be used in a stable-yard!' "'And so I told Marianne when she told me.'
"'Was his lordship not pleased about the child, then?'
Jamie interrupted. "'The omelette was settling into a hard lump somewhere under his breastbone. "'He took another gulp of brandy in hopes of dislodging it. "'The cook turned a bright bird-like eye on him, "'eyebrow cocked in appreciation at his intelligence.
"'Well, you'd think as he would be, wouldn't you? "'But no, indeed. Far from it.'
she added with emphasis.
"'Why not?' said Jeffreys, only mildly interested. "'He said,'
the cook said, dropping her voice in awe at the scandalousness of the information,
"'as the child wasn't his.'
Jeffreys, well along with his second glass, snorted in contemptuous amusement.
"'Old goat with a young girl. I should think it like enough.' "'But how on earth would his lordship know for sure whose the spawn was? "'Could be his as much as anyone's, couldn't it, "'with only her ladyship's word to go by, eh?'
"'The cook's thin mouth stretched in a bright, malicious smile.
"'Oh, I don't say as he'd know whose it was, now, "'but there's one sure way he'd know it wasn't his, now, isn't there?'
"'Jeffreys stared at the cook, tilting back on his chair.
"'What?' he said. "'You mean to tell me his lordship's incapable?'
A broad grin at this juicy thought split his weather-beaten face. Jamie felt the omelette rising and hastily gulped more brandy.
"'Well, I couldn't say, I'm sure.'
The cook's mouth assumed a prim line, then split asunder to add,
"'Though the chambermaid did say as the sheet she took off the wedding bed was as white as when they'd gone on, to be sure.'
It was too much. Interrupting Jeffrey's delighted cackle, Jamie set down his glass with a thump and bluntly said,
"'Did the child live?'
The cook and Jeffrey's both stared in astonishment, but the cook, after a moment's startlement, nodded in answer.
"'Oh, yes, to be sure. Fine, healthy little lad he is, too, or so I hear. I thought you knew already. It's his mother that's dead.'
That blunt statement struck the kitchen with silence. Even Jeffreys was still for a moment, sobered by death. Then he crossed himself quickly, muttered, "God rest her soul," and swallowed the rest of his brandy. Jamie could feel his own throat burning, whether with brandy or tears he couldn't say. Shock and grief choked him like a ball of yarn wedged in his gullet. He could barely manage to croak.
"When?" "'This morning,' the cook said, wagging her head mournfully. "'Just afore noon, poor girl. "'They thought for a time as she'd be all right after the babe was born. "'Mary Ann said she was sitting up, holding the wee thing and laughing.'
"'She sighed heavily at the thought.
"'But then near dawn she started to bleed again bad. "'They called back the doctor and he came as fast as could be, but—'
"'The door, slamming open, interrupted her. "'It was Mary Ann.' "'Eyes wide under her cap, gasping with excitement and exertion.
"'Your master wants you,'
she blurted out, "'eyes flickering between Jamie and the coachman.
"'The both of you at once, and, oh, sir,'
she gulped, nodding at Jeffreys.
"'He says, for God's sake, to bring your pistols.'
"'The coachman exchanged a glance of consternation with Jamie, "'then leapt to his feet and dashed out in the direction of the stables. "'Like most coachmen,' He carried a pair of loaded pistols beneath his seat against the possibility of highwaymen. It would take Jeffreys a few minutes to find the arms, and longer if he waited to check that the priming had not been harmed by the wet weather. Jamie rose to his feet and gripped the dithering maidservant by the arm.
"Show me to the study," he said. "Now."
The sound of raised voices would have led him there once he had reached the head of the stair. Pushing past Mary Ann without ceremony, he paused for a moment outside the door, uncertain whether he should enter at once or wait for Jeffreys.
"That you can have the sheer heartless effrontery to make such accusations,"
Dunsany was saying, his old man's voice shaking with rage and distress.
"And my poor lamb not cold in her bed. You blackguard! You poltroon! I will not suffer the child to stay a single night under your roof."
"The little bastard stays here,"
Ellesmere's voice rasped hoarsely. It would have been apparent to a far less experienced observer that his lordship was well the worse for drink.
"Bastard that he is, he's my heir, and he stays with me. He's bought and paid for, and if his dam was a whore, at least she gave me a boy. Damn you!"
Dunsany's voice had reached such a pitch of shrillness that it was scarcely more than a squeak, but the outrage in it was clear nonetheless.
"Bought? You dare to suggest?" "I don't suggest."
Ellesmere's voice was still hoarse, but under better control.
"You sold me your daughter, and under false pretences, I might add,"
the hoarse voice said sarcastically.
"I paid £30,000 for a virgin of good name. The first condition wasn't met, and I take leave to doubt the second."
The sound of liquid being poured came through the door, followed by the scrape of a glass across a wooden tabletop.
"I would suggest that your burden of spirits is already excessive, sir," Dunsany said.
His voice shook with an obvious attempt at mastery of his emotions.
"I can only attribute the disgusting slurs you have cast upon my daughter's purity to your apparent intoxication. That being so, I shall take my grandson and go."
"Oh, your grandson, is it?"
Ellesmere's voice was slurred and sneering.
"You seem damn sure of your daughter's purity. Sure the brat isn't yours. She said..."
He broke off with a cry of astonishment accompanied by a crash. Not daring to wait longer, Jamie plunged through the door to find Ellesmere and Lord Dunsany entangled on the hearthrug, rolling to and fro in a welter of coats and limbs, both heedless of the fire behind them. He took a moment to appraise the situation, then, seizing a fortuitous opening, reached into the fray and snatched his employer upright.
"Be still, my lord,"
he muttered in Dunsany's ear, dragging him back from Ellesmere's gasping form. Then,
"Give over, ye old fool,"
he hissed, as Dunsany went on mindlessly struggling to reach his opponent. Ellesmere was almost as old as Dunsany, but more strongly built, and clearly in better health, despite his drunkenness. The Earl staggered to his feet, balding hair dishevelled and bloodshot eyes glaring fixedly at Dunsany. He wiped his spittle-flecked mouth with the back of his hand, fat shoulders heaving.
"Filth,"
he said, almost conversationally.
"Lay hands on me, would you?"
Still gasping for breath, he lurched toward the bell rope. It was by no means certain that Lord Dunsany would stay on his feet, but there was no time to worry about that. Jamie let go of his employer and lunged for Ellesmere's groping hand.
"No, my lord,"
he said, as respectfully as possible. Holding Ellesmere in a crude, bear-leading embrace, he forced the heavy-set Earl back across the room.
"I think it would be unwise to involve your servants."
Grunting, he pushed Ellesmere into a chair.
"Best stay there, my lord."
Jeffreys, a drawn pistol in each hand, advanced warily into the room, his darting glance divided between Ellesmere, struggling to rise from the depths of the armchair, and Lord Dunsany, who clung precariously to a table edge, his aged face white as paper. Jeffreys glanced at Dunsany for instructions, and seeing none forthcoming, instinctively looked to Jamie. Jamie was conscious of a monstrous irritation. Why should he be expected to deal with this imbroglio? Still, It was important that the Hellwater party remove themselves from the premises with all haste. He stepped forward and took Dunsany by the arm.
"Let us go now, my lord," he said.
Detaching the wilting Dunsany from the table, he tried to edge the tall old nobleman toward the door. Just at this moment of escape, though, the door was blocked.
"William?"
Lady Dunsany's round face, splotched with the marks of recent grief, showed a sort of dull bewilderment at the scene in the study. In her arms was what looked like a large, untidy bundle of washing. She lifted this in a movement of vague inquiry.
"The maid said you wanted me to bring the baby. What?"
A roar from Ellesmere interrupted her. Heedless of the pointing pistols, the Earl sprang from his chair and shoved the gawking Jeffreys out of the way.
"He's mine!"
Knocking Lady Dunsany roughly against the panelling, Ellesmere snatched the bundle from her arms. Clutching it to his bosom, the Earl retreated toward the window. He glared at Dunsany, panting like a cornered beast.
"Mind ye hear?"
The bundle emitted a loud shriek, as if in protest at this asseveration, and Dunsany, roused from his shock by the sight of his grandson in Ellesmere's arms, started forward, his features contorted in fury.
"Give him to me!"
"Go to hell, you codless scut!"
With an unforeseen agility, Ellesmere dodged away from Dunsany. He flung back the draperies and cranked the window open with one hand, clutching the wailing child with the other.
"Get out of my house!" he panted,
gasping with each revolution that edged the casement wider.
"Go, now, or I'll drop the little bastard. I swear I will."
To mark his threat, he thrust the yelling bundle toward the sill and the empty dark where the wet stones of the courtyard waited, 30 feet below. Past all conscious thought or any fear of consequence, Jamie Fraser acted on the instinct that had seen him through a dozen battles. He snatched one pistol from the transfixed Jeffreys, turned on his heel, and fired in the same motion. The roar of the shot struck everyone silent. Even the child ceased to scream. Ellesmere's face went quite blank, thick eyebrows raised in question. Then he staggered, and Jamie leapt forward, noting with a sort of detached clarity the small round hole in the baby's trailing drapery where the pistol ball had passed through it. He stood then, rooted on the hearthrug, heedless of the fire scorching the backs of his legs, of the still heaving body of Ellesmere at his feet, of the regular hysterical shrieks of Lady Dunsany piercing as a peacock's. He stood, eyes tight closed, shaking like a leaf, unable either to move or to think, arms wrapped tight around the shapeless, squirming, squawking bundle that contained his son.
"I wish to speak to Mackenzie, alone."
Lady Dunsany looked distinctly out of place in the stable. Small, plump, and impeccable in black linen, she looked like a china ornament, removed from its spot of cherished safety on the mantelpiece, and in imminent and constant peril of breakage, here in this world of rough animals and unshaven men. Hughes, with a glance of complete astonishment at his mistress, bowed and tugged at his forelock before retreating to his den behind the tack room, leaving Mackenzie face to face with her. Close to, the impression of fragility was heightened by the paleness of her face, touched faintly with pink at the corners of nose and eyes. She looked like a very small and dignified rabbit dressed in mourning. Jamie felt that he should ask her to sit down, but there was no place for her to sit, save on a pile of hay or an upturned barrow.
"The coroner's court met this morning, Mackenzie," she said.
"Aye, milady."
He had known that. They all had, and the other grooms had kept their distance from him all morning. Not out of respect, out of the dread for one who suffers from a deadly disease. Jeffreys knew what had happened in the drawing-room at Ellesmere, and that meant all the servants knew, but no one spoke of it.
"The verdict of the court was that the Earl of Ellesmere met his death by misadventure. The coroner's theory is that his lordship was distraught,"
She made a faint moo of distaste over my daughter's death. Her voice quivered faintly, but did not break. The fragile Lady Dunsany had borne up much better beneath the tragedy than had her husband. The servants' rumour had it that his lordship hadn't risen from his bed since his return from Ellesmere.
"'Aye, milady.'
Jeffreys had been called to give evidence. Mackenzie had not. So far as the coroner's court was concerned, the groom Mackenzie had never set foot on Ellesmere. Lady Dunsany's eyes met his straight on. They were a pale bluish-green, like her daughter Isabel's, but the blonde hair that glowed on Isabel was faded on her mother, touched with white strands that shone silver in the sun from the open door of the stable.
"'We are grateful to you, Mackenzie,' she said quietly.
"'Thank you, milady.'
"'Very grateful,'
she repeated, still gazing at him intently.
"'Mackenzie isn't your real name, is it?'
she said suddenly.
"'No, milady.'
A sliver of ice ran down his spine, despite the warmth of the afternoon sun on his shoulders. How much had the Lady Geneva told her mother before her death? She seemed to feel his stiffening, for the edge of her mouth lifted in what he thought was meant as a smile of reassurance.
"'I think I need not ask what it is just yet,' she said. "'But I do have a question for you. Mackenzie, do you want to go home?'
"'Home?'
He repeated the word blankly.
"'To Scotland?'
She was watching him intently.
"'I know who you are,' she said. "'Not your name, but that you're one of John's Jacobite prisoners. "'My husband told me.'
Jamie watched her warily, but she didn't seem upset, no more so than would be natural in a woman who has just lost a daughter and gained a grandson, at least.
"'I hope you will forgive the deception, milady,' he said. "'His lordship
wished to save me distress,'
Lady Dunsany finished for him.
"'Yes, I know.' William worries too much.
Still, the deep line between her brows relaxed a bit at the thought of her husband's concern. The sight, with its underlying echo of marital devotion, gave him a faint and unexpected pang.
"'We are not rich. You will have gathered that from Ellesmere's remarks,'
Lady Dunsany went on.
"'Hellwater is rather heavily in debt. My grandson, however, is now the possessor of one of the largest fortunes in the county.
There seemed nothing to say to this, but
I, milady,
though it made him feel rather like the parrot who lived in the main salon. He had seen it as he crept stealthily through the flower beds at sunset the day before, taking the chance of approaching the house while the family were dressing for dinner, in an attempt to catch a glimpse through the window of the new Earl of Ellesmere.
We are very retired here, she went on. We seldom visit London, and my husband has little influence in high circles, but...
Aye, milady.
He had some inkling by now of where her ladyship was heading with this roundabout conversation, and a feeling of sudden excitement hollowed the space beneath his ribs.
John, Lord Grey, that is, comes from a family with considerable influence. His stepfather is... Well, that's of no consequence.
She shrugged, the small black linen shoulders dismissing the details.
The point is that it might be possible to exert sufficient influence on your behalf to have you released from the conditions of your parole, so that you might return to Scotland. So I have come to ask you, do you want to go home, Mackenzie?
He felt quite breathless, as though someone had punched him very hard in the stomach.
Scotland.
To go away from this damp, spongy atmosphere, set foot on that forbidden road and walk it with a free, long stride up into the crags and along the deer trails, to feel the air clearing and sharpening with the scent of gorse and heather. To go home. To be a stranger no longer. To go away from hostility and loneliness, come down into Lallybroch and see his sister's face light with joy at the sight of him. Feel her arms around his waist, Ian's hug about his shoulders, and the pummeling, grasping clutch of the children's hands tugging at his clothes. To go away, and never to see or hear of his own child again. He stared at Lady Dunsany, his face quite blank, so that she shouldn't guess at the turmoil her offer had caused within him. He had, at last, found the baby yesterday, lying asleep in a basket near the nursery window on the second floor. Perched precariously on the branch of a huge Norway spruce, he had strained his eyes to see through the screen of needles that hid him. The child's face had been visible only in profile, one fat cheek resting on its ruffled shoulder. Its cap had slipped awry, so he could see the smooth, arching curve of the tiny skull, lightly dusted with a pale gold fuzz.
"Thank God it isn't red,"
had been his first thought, and he had crossed himself in reflexive thanksgiving.
"God, he's so small,"
had been his second, coupled with an overwhelming urge to step through the window and pick the boy up. The smooth, beautifully shaped head would just fit, resting in the palm of his hand, and he could feel in memory the small, squirming body that he had held so briefly to his heart.
"You're a strong laddie," he had whispered, "strong and braw and bonny. But my God, you are so small."
Lady Dunsany was waiting patiently. He bowed his head respectfully to her, not knowing whether he was making a terrible mistake, but unable to do otherwise.
"I thank you, milady, but I think I shall not go just yet."
One pale eyebrow quivered slightly, but she inclined her head to him with equal grace.
"As you wish, Mackenzie. You have only to ask."
She turned like a tiny clockwork figure and left, going back to the world of Hellwater, 1,000 times more his prison now than it had ever been. Chapter 16. Willie. To his extreme surprise, the next few years were in many ways among the happiest of Jamie Fraser's life, aside from the years of his marriage. Relieved of responsibility for tenants, followers, or anyone at all beyond himself and the horses in his charge, life was relatively simple. While the coroner's court had taken no notice of him, Jeffreys had let slip enough about the death of Ellesmere that the other servants treated him with distant respect, but didn't presume on his company. He had enough to eat, sufficient clothes to keep warm and decent, and the occasional discreet letter from the Highlands reassured him that similar conditions obtained there. One unexpected benefit of the quiet life at Hellwater was that he had somehow resumed his odd half-friendship with Lord Grey. The Major had, as promised, appeared once each quarter, staying each time for a few days to visit with the Dunsanys. He had made no attempt to gloat, though, or even to speak with Jamie, beyond the barest formal inquiry. Very slowly, Jamie had realised all that Lady Dunsany had implied in her offer to have him released. John, Lord Grey, that is, comes from a family with considerable influence. His stepfather is, well, that's of no consequence, she had said. It was of consequence, though. It hadn't been His Majesty's pleasure that had brought him here, rather than condemning him to the perilous ocean crossing and near slavery in America. It had been John Grey's influence. And he hadn't done it for revenge or from indecent motives, for he never gloated, made no advances, never said anything beyond the most commonplace civilities. No, he had brought Jamie here because it was the best he could do. Unable simply to release him at the time, Grey had done his best to ease the conditions of captivity by giving him air and light and horses. It took some effort, but he did it. When Grey next appeared in the stable yard on his quarterly visit, Jamie had waited until the Major was alone, admiring the conformation of a big sorrel gelding. He had come to stand beside Grey, leaning on the fence. They watched the horse in silence for several minutes.
"King's pawn to King Four," Jamie said quietly at last, not looking at the man beside him.
He felt the other's start of surprise, and felt Grey's eyes on him, but didn't turn his head. Then he felt the creak of the wood beneath his forearm as Grey turned back, leaning on the fence again.
"Queen's Knight to Queen Bishop Three," Grey replied,
his voice a little huskier than usual. Since then, Grey had come to the stables during each visit to spend an evening perched on Jamie's crude stool, talking. They had no chessboard and seldom played verbally, but the late-night conversations continued. Jamie's only connection with the world beyond Hellwater, and a small pleasure to which both of them looked forward once each quarter. Above everything else, he had Willie. Hellwater was dedicated to horses. Even before the boy could stand solidly on his feet, his grandfather had him propped on a pony to be led round the paddock. By the time Willie was three, he was riding by himself, under the watchful eye of Mackenzie, the groom. Willie was a strong, courageous, bonny little lad. He had a blinding smile and could charm birds from the trees if he liked. He was also remarkably spoilt. As the 9th Earl of Ellesmere and the only heir to both Ellesmere and Hellwater, with neither mother nor father to keep him under control, he ran roughshod over his doting grandparents, his young aunt, and every servant in the place, except Mackenzie. And that was a near thing. So far, threats of not allowing the boy to help him with the horses had sufficed to quash Willie's worst excesses in the stables. But sooner or later, threats alone were not going to be sufficient, and Mackenzie, the groom, found himself wondering just what was going to happen when he finally lost his own control and clouted the wee fiend. As a lad, he would himself have been beaten senseless by the nearest male relative within earshot, had he ever dared to address a woman the way he had heard Willie speak to his aunt and the maidservants. And the impulse to haul Willie into a deserted box stall and attempt to correct his manners was increasingly frequent. Still, for the most part, he had nothing but joy in Willie. The boy adored Mackenzie, and as he grew older would spend hours in his company, riding on the huge draft horses as they pulled the heavy roller through the high fields, and perched precariously on the hay wagons as they came down from the upper pastures in summer. There was a threat to this peaceful existence, though, which grew greater with each passing month. Ironically, the threat came from Willie himself, and was one he couldn't help. "What a handsome little lad he is, to be sure, and such a lovely little rider!" It was Lady Grozier who spoke, standing on the veranda with Lady Dunsany to admire Willie's peregrinations on his pony around the edge of the lawn. Willie's grandmother laughed, eyeing the boy fondly. "Oh, yes, he loves his pony. We have a terrible time getting him even to come indoors for meals. And he's even more fond of his groom. We joke sometimes that he spends so much time with Mackenzie that he's even starting to look like Mackenzie." Lady Grozier, who had, of course, paid no attention to a groom, now glanced in Mackenzie's direction. "Why, you're right!" she exclaimed, much amused. "Just look! Willie's got just that same cock to his head and the same set to his shoulders. How funny!" Jamie bowed respectfully to the ladies, but felt cold sweat pop out on his face. He had seen this coming, but hadn't wanted to believe the resemblance was sufficiently pronounced as to be visible to anyone but himself. Willie, as a baby, had been fat and pudding-faced, and resembled no one at all. As he had grown, though, the pudginess had vanished from cheeks and chin, and while his nose was still the soft snub of childhood, the hint of high, broad cheekbones was apparent, and the slaty blue eyes of babyhood had grown dark blue and clear, thickly fringed with sooty lashes, and slightly slanted in appearance. Once the ladies had gone into the house and he could be sure no one was watching, Jamie passed a hand furtively over his own features. Was the resemblance truly that great? Willie's hair was a soft middle brown with just a tinge of his mother's chestnut gleam. And those large translucent ears. Surely his own didn't stick out like that. The trouble was that Jamie Fraser hadn't actually seen himself clearly for several years. Grooms didn't have looking glasses, and he had sedulously avoided the company of the maids who might have provided him with one. Moving to the watering trough, he bent over it casually, as though inspecting one of the water striders that skated over its surface. Beneath the wavering surface, flecked with floating bits of hay and criss-crossed by the dimpling striders, his own face stared up at him. He swallowed and saw the reflection's throat move. It was by no means a complete resemblance, but it was definitely there. More in the set and shape of the head and shoulders, as Lady Grozier had observed, but most definitely the eyes as well. Fraser eyes. His father Brian had had them, and his sister Jenny as well. Let the boy's bones go on pressing through his skin. Let the child's snub nose grow long and straight, and the cheekbones still broader, and anyone would be able to see it. The reflection in the trough vanished as he straightened up and stood staring blindly at the stable that had been home for the last several years. It was July, and the sun was hot, but it made no impression on the chill that numbed his fingers and sent a shiver up his back. It was time to speak to Lady Dunsany. By the middle of September, everything had been arranged. The pardon had been procured. John Grey had brought it the day before. Jamie had a small amount of money saved, enough for travelling expenses, and Lady Dunsany had given him a decent horse. The only thing that remained was to bid farewell to his acquaintances at Hellwater and Willie.
"I shall be leaving tomorrow,"
Jamie spoke matter-of-factly, not taking his eyes off the bay mare's fetlock. The horny growth he was filing flaked away, leaving a dust of coarse black shavings on the stable floor.
"Where are you going? To Derwentwater? Can I come with you?"
William, Viscount Dunsany, 9th Earl of Ellesmere, hopped down from the edge of the box stall, landing with a thump that made the bay mare start and snort.
"Don't do that," Jamie said automatically. "Have I not told you to move quiet near Millie? She's skittish."
"Why?"
"You'd be skittish too if I squeezed your knee."
One big hand darted out and pinched the muscle just above the boy's knee. Willie squeaked and jerked back, giggling.
"Can I ride Millie Flower when you're done, Mac?"
"No," Jamie answered patiently for the dozenth time that day. "I've told you 1,000 times. She's too big for you yet."
"But I want to ride her."
Jamie sighed, but didn't answer. Instead, moving around to the other side of Millefleur and picking up the left hoof.
"I said I want to ride Millie."
"I heard you."
"Then saddle her for me, right now."
The 9th Earl of Ellesmere had his chin thrust out as far as it would go, but the defiant look in his eye was tempered with a certain doubt as he intercepted Jamie's cold blue gaze. Jamie set the horse's hoof down slowly, just as slowly stood up, and drawing himself to his full height of 6'4", put his hands on his hips, looked down at the Earl, 3'6", and said very softly,
"No."
"Yes."
Willie stamped his foot on the hay-strewn floor.
"You have to do what I tell you."
"No, I don't."
"Yes, you do."
"No, I..."
Shaking his head hard enough to make the red hair fly about his ears, Jamie pressed his lips tight together, then squatted down in front of the boy.
"See here," he said. "I havena got to do what you see, for I'm no longer going to be groom here. I told you, I should be leaving tomorrow."
Willie's face went quite blank with shock, and the freckles on his nose stood out dark against the fair skin.
"You can't," he said. "You can't leave."
"I have to."
"No."
The small earl clenched his jaw, which gave him a truly startling resemblance to his paternal great-grandfather. Jamie thanked his stars that no one at Hellwater had likely ever seen Simon Fraser, Lord Lovett.
"I won't let you go."
"For once, my lord, you have nothing to say about it," Jamie replied firmly, his distress at leaving tempered somewhat by finally being allowed to speak his mind to the boy.
"If you leave..."
Willie looked around helplessly for a threat, and spotted one easily to hand.
"If you leave," he repeated more confidently, "I'll scream and shout and scare all the horses. So there."
"Make a peep, you little fiend, and I'll smack you a good one."
Freed from his usual reserve, and alarmed at the thought of this spoiled brat upsetting the highly strung and valuable horses, Jamie glared at the boy. The Earl's eyes bulged with rage, and his face went red. He took a deep breath, then whirled and ran down the length of the stable, shrieking and waving his arms. Millefleur, already on edge from having her hooves fiddled with, reared and plunged, neighing loudly. Her distress was echoed by kicks and high-pitched whinnying from the box stalls nearby, where Willie was roaring out all the bad words he knew, no small store, and kicking frenziedly at the doors of the stalls. Jamie succeeded in catching Millefleur's lead rope, and with considerable effort managed to get the mare outside without damage to himself or the horse. He tied her to the paddock fence, then strode back into the stable to deal with Willie.
"Damn! Damn! Damn!" the Earl was shrieking. "Slur! Quim! Shit! Swave!"
Without a word, Jamie grabbed the boy by the collar, lifted him off his feet, and carried him, kicking and squirming, to the farrier's stool he had been using. Here he sat down, flipped the Earl over his knee, and smacked his buttocks 5 or 6 times, hard. Then he jerked the boy up and set him on his feet.
"I hate you!"
The Earl's tear-smudged face was bright red, and his fists trembled with rage.
"Well, I'm no very fond of you either, you little bastard," Jamie snapped.
Willie drew himself up, fists clenched, purple in the face.
"I'm not a bastard," he shrieked. I'm not. Take it back. Nobody can say that to me. Take it back," I said.
Jamie stared at the boy in shock. There had been talk then, and Willie had heard it. He had delayed his going too long. He drew a deep breath, and then another, and hoped that his voice wouldn't tremble.
"I take it back," he said softly. "I shouldn't have used the word, my lord."
He wanted to kneel and embrace the boy, or pick him up and comfort him against his shoulder. But that was not a gesture a groom might make to an earl, even a young one. The palm of his left hand stung, and he curled his fingers tightly over the only fatherly caress he was ever likely to give his son. Willie knew how an earl should behave. He was making a masterful effort to subdue his tears, sniffing ferociously and swiping at his face with a sleeve.
"Allow me, my lord."
Jamie did kneel then, and wiped the little boy's face gently with his own coarse handkerchief. Willie's eyes looked at him over the cotton folds, red-rimmed and woeful.
"Have you really got to go, Mac?"
he asked in a very small voice.
"Aye, I have."
He looked into the dark blue eyes, so heartbreakingly like his own, and suddenly didn't give a damn what was right or who saw. He pulled the boy roughly to him, hugging him tight against his heart, holding the boy's face close to his shoulder, that Willie might not see the quick tears that fell into his thick, soft hair. Willie's arms went around his neck and clung tight. He could feel the small, sturdy body shake against him with the force of suppressed sobbing. He patted the flat little back and smoothed Willie's hair and murmured things in Gaelic that he hoped the boy wouldn't understand. At length, he took the boy's arms from his neck and put him gently away.
"Come wi' me to my room, Willie. I shall give you something to keep."
He had long since moved from the hayloft, taking over Hugh's snuggery beside the tack room when the elderly head groom retired. It was a small room and very plainly furnished, but it had the twin virtues of warmth and privacy.
This ends Disc 8. Voyager, Disc 9.
Beside the bed, the stool, and a chamber pot, there was a small table on which stood the few books that he owned, a large candle in a pottery candlestick, and a smaller candle, thick and squat, that stood to one side before a small statue of the Virgin. It was a cheap wooden carving that Jenny had sent him, but it had been made in France and wasn't without artistry.
"What's that little candle for?" Willie asked. "Granny says only stinking papists burn candles in front of heathen images."
"Well, I am a stinking peepist, Jamie said, with a wry twist of his mouth. It's no a heathen image, though. It's a statue of the Blessed Mother.
You are?
Clearly, this revelation only added to the boy's fascination.
Why do papists burn candles before statues, then?
Jamie rubbed a hand through his hair.
Aye, well, it's maybe a way of praying and remembering. You light the candle and say a prayer and think of people you care for, and while it burns, the flame remembers them for you.
Who do you remember?
Willie glanced up at him. His hair was standing on end, rumpled by his earlier distress, but his blue eyes were clear with interest.
Oh, a good many people. My family in the Highlands, my sister and her family, friends, my wife.
And sometimes the candle burned in memory of a young and reckless girl named Geneva, but he didn't say that. Willie frowned.
You haven't got a wife?
No, not any more. But I remember her always.
Willie put out a stubby forefinger and cautiously touched the little statue. The woman's hands were spread in welcome, a tender maternity engraved on the lovely face.
I want to be a stinking papist too,
Willie said firmly.
You cannot do that,
Jamie exclaimed, half amused, half touched at the notion.
Your grandmama and your auntie would go mad.
Would they froth at the mouth, like that mad fox you killed?
Willie brightened.
I shouldn't wonder,
Jamie said dryly.
I want to do it.
The small, clear features were set in determination.
I won't tell Granny or Auntie Isabel. I won't tell anybody. Please, Mac, please let me. I want to be like you.
Jamie hesitated, both touched by the boy's earnestness and suddenly wanting to leave his son with something more than the carved wooden horse he had made to leave as a farewell present. He tried to remember what Father McMurtry had taught them in the schoolroom about baptism. It was all right for a layperson to do it, he thought, provided that the situation was an emergency and no priest was to hand. It might be stretching a point to call the present situation an emergency, but... A sudden impulse made him reach down the jug of water that he kept on the sill. The eyes that were like his watched, wide and solemn, as he carefully brushed the soft brown hair back from the high brow. He dipped three fingers into the water and carefully traced a cross on the lad's forehead.
"I baptize thee William James," he said softly. "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen."
Willie blinked, crossing his eyes as a drop of water rolled down his nose. He stuck out his tongue to catch it, and Jamie laughed, despite himself.
"Why did you call me William James?"
Willie asked curiously.
"My other names are Clarence Henry George."
He made a face. Clarence wasn't his idea of a good name. Jamie hid a smile.
"You get a new name when you're baptized. James is your special papist name. It's mine too."
"It is?"
Willie was delighted.
"I'm a stinking papist now, like you."
"Aye, as much as I can manage at least."
He smiled down at Willie, then, struck by another impulse, reached into the neck of his shirt.
"Here, keep this too, to remember me by."
He laid the beechwood rosary gently over Willie's head.
"You canna let anyone see that, though," he warned. "And for God's sake, dinna tell anyone you're a papist."
"I won't," Willie promised. "Not a soul."
He tucked the rosary into his shirt, patting carefully to be sure that it was hidden.
"Good."
Jamie reached out and ruffled Willie's hair in dismissal.
"It's almost time for your tea. You'd best go on up to the house now."
Willie started for the door, but stopped halfway, suddenly distressed again, with a hand pressed flat to his chest.
"You said to keep this to remember you, but I haven't got anything for you to remember me by."
Jamie smiled slightly. His heart was squeezed so tight he thought he couldn't draw breath to speak, but he forced the words out.
"Dinna fret yourself," he said. I'll remember you.
Chapter 17. Monsters Rising. Loch Ness, August 1968. Brianna blinked, brushing back a bright web of hair caught by the wind.
I'd almost forgotten what the sun looks like, she said,
squinting at the object in question, shining with unaccustomed ferocity on the dark waters of Loch Ness. Her mother stretched luxuriously, enjoying the light wind,
to say nothing of what fresh air is like.
I feel like a toadstool that's been growing in the dark for weeks, all pale and squashy.
Fine scholars the two of you would make,
Roger said, but grinned. All three of them were in high spirits. After the arduous slog through the prison records to narrow the search to Ardsmuir, they had had a run of luck. The records for Ardsmuir were complete, in one spot, and in comparison to most others, remarkably clear. Ardsmuir had been a prison for only 15 years. Following its renovation by Jacobite prison labour, it had been converted into a small permanent garrison, and the prison population dispersed, mostly transported to the American colonies.
I still can't imagine why Fraser wasn't sent along to America with the rest, Roger said.
He had had a moment's panic there, going over and over the list of transported convicts from Ardsmuir, searching the names one by one, nearly letter by letter, and still finding no Frasers. He had been certain that Jamie Fraser had died in prison, and had been in a cold sweat of fear over the thought of telling the Randall women, until the flip of a page had showed him Fraser's parole to a place named Hellwater.
"I don't know," Claire said. "But it's a bloody good thing he wasn't. He's... he was..."
She caught herself quickly, but not quickly enough to stop Roger noticing the slip. "Terribly, terribly seasick." She gestured at the surface of the loch before them, dancing with tiny waves. Even going out on something like that would turn him green in minutes. Roger glanced at Brianna with interest.
Are you seasick?
She shook her head, bright hair lifting in the wind.
Nah.
She patted her bare midriff smugly.
Cast iron.
Roger laughed.
Want to go out then? It's your holiday after all.
Really? Could we? Can you fish in there?
Brianna shaded her eyes, looking eagerly out over the dark water.
Certainly. I've caught salmon and eels many a time in Loch Ness, Roger assured her. Come along. We'll rent a wee boat at the dock in Drumna Drochet.
The drive to Drumna Drochet was a delight. The day was one of those clear, bright summer days that caused tourists from the south to stampede into Scotland in droves during August and September. With one of Fiona's larger breakfasts inside him, one of her lunches stowed in a basket in the boot, and Brianna Randall, long hair blowing in the wind, seated beside him, Roger was strongly disposed to consider that all was right with the world. He allowed himself to dwell with satisfaction on the results of their researches. It had meant taking additional leave from his college for the summer term, but it had been worth it. After finding the record of James Fraser's parole, it had taken another 2 weeks of slog and inquiry, even a quick weekend trip by Roger and Bree to the Lake District, another by all three of them to London, and then the sight that had made Brianna whoop out loud in the middle of the British Museum's sacrosanct reading room, causing their hasty departure amid waves of icy disapproval. The sight of the Royal Warrant of Pardon, stamped with the seal of George III, Rex Angleterre, dated 1764, bearing the name of James Alexander Mackenzie Fraser.
"We're getting close," Roger had said, gloating over the photocopy of the warrant of pardon. "Bloody close!"
"Close?"
Brianna had said, but then had been distracted by the sight of their bus approaching and hadn't pursued the matter. Roger had caught Claire's eye on him, though. She knew very well what he meant.
She would, of course, have been thinking of it.
He wondered whether Brianna had. Claire had disappeared into the past in 1945, vanishing through the circle of standing stones on Craignadun. and reappearing in 1743. She had lived with Jamie Fraser for nearly 3 years, then returned through the stones. And she had come back nearly 3 years past the time of her original disappearance, in April of 1948. All of which meant, just possibly, that if she were disposed to try the trip back through the stones once more, she would likely arrive 20 years past the time she had left, in 1766. And 1766 was only 2 years past the latest known date at which Jamie Fraser had been located, alive and well. If he had survived another 2 years, and if Roger could find him...
"There it is," Brianna said suddenly. "Boats for rent."
She pointed at the sign in the window of the dockside pub, and Roger nosed the car into a parking slot outside, with no further thought of Jamie Fraser.
"I wonder why short men are so often enamoured of very tall women."
Claire's voice behind him echoed Roger's thoughts with an uncanny accuracy, and not for the first time. "Moth and flame syndrome, perhaps," Roger suggested, frowning at the diminutive barman's evident fascination with Brianna.
He and Claire were standing before the counter for rentals, waiting for the clerk to write up the receipt, while Brianna bought bottles of Coca-Cola and brown ale to augment their lunch.
The young barman, who came up approximately to Brianna's armpit, was hopping to and fro, offering pickled eggs and slices of smoked tongue, eyes worshipfully upturned to the yellow-haltered goddess before him. From her laughter, Brianna appeared to think the man cute.
"I always told Bree not to get involved with short men," Claire observed, watching this.
"Did you?" Roger said dryly. "Somehow I didn't envision you being all that much in the motherly advice line." She laughed, disregarding his momentary sourness.
"Well, I'm not all that much. When you notice an important principle like that, though, it seems one's motherly duty to pass it along."
"Something wrong with short men, is there?" Roger inquired.
"They tend to turn mean if they don't get their way," Claire answered. "Like small yapping dogs. Cute and fluffy, but cross them and you're likely to get a nasty nip in the ankle."
Roger laughed.
"This observation is the result of years of experience, I take it."
"Oh, yes," she nodded, glancing up at him.
"I've never met an orchestra conductor over 5 feet tall. Vicious specimens, practically all of them. But tall men..."
Her lips curved slightly as she surveyed his 6'3" frame. "Tall men are almost always very sweet and gentle."
"Sweetie," said Roger,
with a cynical glance at the barman, who was cutting up a jellied eel for Brianna. Her face expressed a wary distaste, but she leaned forward, wrinkling her nose as she took the bite offered on a fork.
"With women," Claire amplified. "I've always thought it's because they realise they don't have anything to prove. When it's perfectly obvious, they can do anything they like, whether you want them to or not. They don't need to try to prove it."
"While a short man," Roger prompted.
"While a short one knows he can't do anything unless you let him. And the knowledge drives him mad, so he's always trying something on, just to prove he can."
"Mm-hmm."
Roger made a Scottish noise in the back of his throat, meant to convey both appreciation of Claire's acuity and general suspicion of what the barman might be wanting to prove to Brianna.
"Thanks," he said to the clerk, who shoved the receipt across the counter to him. "Ready, Bree?" he asked.
The loch was calm and the fishing slow, but it was pleasant on the water, with the August sun warm on their backs, and the scent of raspberry canes and sun-warmed pine trees wafting from the nearby shore. Full of lunch, they all grew drowsy, and before long, Brianna was curled up in the bow, asleep with her head pillowed on Roger's jacket. Claire sat in the stern, blinking, but still awake.
"What about short and tall women?"
Roger asked, resuming their earlier conversation as he sculled slowly across the loch. He glanced over his shoulder at the amazing length of Brianna's legs, awkwardly curled under her.
"Same thing. The little one's nasty."
Claire shook her head meditatively, the curls beginning to work their way loose from her hair clip.
No, I don't think so. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with size. I think it's more a matter of whether they see men as the enemy